Everything changes like the desert wind. Here she comes and then she's gone again. And I'm just a traveler on this earth. Showing my heart behind the pocket of my shirt.
This is Lee Habib and this is Our American Stories. And as you know now, there's no hot political talk here. You're going to have to go somewhere else. It's stories and only stories here on Our American Stories. And we love music. You heard our hour on Robert Plant, his two trips to America. The Delta Blues first, and then Nashville and beyond. Getting back in touch with his roots. Gospel songs and Americana. And today, we're getting into and digging into the life of an American music producer. And we've brought a few of those lives to you as well, Rick Rubens. And now someone who I think is, and I think he's going to almost blush when we say this, but I think it's true, joining the ranks of Rick with some of the artists. I know, oh no, I hate doing that to you. But it's Dave Cobb, who we read about in the Wall Street Journal. I'm a big music fan, so I've known Dave's work and been following the artists he's been getting behind and just getting the best out of, which I think is what producers or great directors do, is they get the best performance out of an artist. And actually, it's what coaches do in the end. And we love talking about coaches, John Wooden and Coach Krzyzewski. And it's all about pulling the God-given talent out of and the potential out of a human being. And Dave Cobb, your artist, Chris Stapleton, Jason Isbell, Sturgill Simpson, Lake Street Drive. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it, man. Too nice.
Hey, you bet. And, hey, look, before we start, we always like to talk to everybody on our show about their life, about their childhood in particular, and how it shaped who you are and what you do. Talk about that, if you could, with us, Dave.
Well, I grew up, I'm from Savannah, Georgia, and I grew up in Pentecostal church. My grandmother was a minister, so we always had, in our church, we did pretty much hymnal-based music and, you know, pedal steel, piano, guitar, and bass, and, you know, kind of a choir singing the whole time. You know, when I was a kid, I was into Black Sabbath and AC/DC and Van Halen and Led Zeppelin and pretty much anything but how I grew up. And I had to move to California and really learn about country music way late in life and to kind of discover where you came from in the first place, you know?
You bet. So you bet. And you actually moved away from the South. Talk about that.
I did at 27. At 27, I moved. I was in a band, and my band's record deal was kind of getting stuck, and I felt like, you know, I really felt a calling to be in the studio, and I felt like California was the place to go, so I ran all the way to California to produce rock records. And when I got out to California at 27, I met Sheeter Jennings, Waylon Jennings' son, and we produced his first record, and that wound up being my first hit country record. And next thing you know, through him, I met Jamie Johnson and was starting to, I did a couple songs in his first record, about seven on the second record, and just kind of kept coming to Nashville after that. So eventually I kind of really discovered great country music through the Jennings, you know. It was really him educating me, playing me the right records, and then I discovered all the stuff I didn't know about growing up, you know.
And talk about some of those right records. Talk about some of the music you may have passed over when you were young, but as you got older you went, my goodness, this is really good.
Well, the gateway record for me was this concept record called White Mansions that an English guy, Paul Kennelly, wrote about the American Civil War. And it had Glenn Johns, my favorite English producer, produce the record. And he had Waylon Jennings and Jesse Coulter. And when I heard that record, it was my gateway into country music, which was really kind of a back way to get into it. And then I discovered, you know, how great Waylon was, and I started buying every Waylon record I could. And I discovered all the offshoots of that, everybody else, all his contemporaries, you know, Jerry Reed, and started diving into everything with that, and, you know, Glenn Campbell, and started going crazy on Glenn Campbell, and just I kept kind of digging and digging and digging, and then, you know, it's been, you know, kind of like a rebirth musically to hear all these great country records that I never knew about. I mean, in our house we had, you know, the poppiest of the pop country records that we had. I mean, it was a Barbara Mandrell record or Kenny Rogers, but I didn't know about Johnny Paycheck, you know.
Right.
So it's you know, or even Marty Robbins, you know. So it's continual learning for me. It's kind of this huge wealth of music that I'm still digging into, and I'm always excited about. You know,
what struck me about country, as you can tell from my accent, we broadcast here from Oxford, Mississippi, But I grew up in New Jersey, northern New Jersey, right by New York City, and I was a huge Springsteen fan. And when he started dipping into the river, when he started dipping into Drive All Night, and he was trying desperately in Nebraska, I think, to become a country artist, to become Johnny Cash almost.
You hear it clear as day. He's in the country. You know, you hear it. You can tell he was a big Christopherson fan.
You bet.
You just hear it in the lyrics. And yeah, he's digging from the same well, that classic American music, you know, whether it be country or roots or whatever you want to call it. He definitely knew what was going on.
No, the first time folks heard him at the Beacon Theater come out alone, and I don't know what compelled him to do this. I think he just needed to shed the band and say, I want folks to hear my songs. And I wanted to hear the character-driven nature of the narratives, because I don't think a lot of people had understood that so many of his songs were driven by the narrative of a character that he was playing in the song, which is a true country, a real true in country tradition. Talk about that, if you could.
Well, you know, I think with country, it all begins with a song. I mean, it's always less about the track than it is the lyrics themselves. The lyrics are always number one. And I think maybe country has the highest regard, you know, with lyrics. I mean, you know, rock and roll, you can go, I want to rock and roll all night, party every day, and people love it and they feel it. But country, you got to have a derivative, you got to have a narrative, you know. It's more about the narrative than it is about the party. And, you know, maybe they party in it too, but there's definitely a story. There's always a link. And I think the songcraft is very high. It's very high form songcraft. So, you know, there are great country songs that take you a while to digest and figure out all the lyrics. So, you know, I think maybe as I'm getting older, I love country music more and more because I need more than just a melody. I need it all, you know, at this point.
Yeah, and obviously the music then serves the song rather than the other way around, and that's a very different thing than listening to a Zeppelin song where the lyric's important, but clearly the track is what snaps you into the world of Led Zeppelin.
Oh, absolutely. You think about Led Zeppelin, you think of, you know, any hit, you know, you think of the guitar riff first, you know what I mean?
Oh, I get it. And Dave, hold the thought. We're coming up against a break. We're talking to Dave Cobb, producer extraordinaire. I know he's just, he can't handle me saying that. He's humble, he's working with great artists, and he always wants to throw the credit on them, but my goodness, they speak highly of him. When we come back, more about Dave's life, and then the art of being a producer, here on Our American Stories. We'll be back after these messages.
Throwing shadows in the dark, and the memories keep on turning to the rhythm of a prayer. Most of you could care less, and the rest don't give a damn. Your accent's fresh on notice when you take a look at me. I'm everything you've ever been, ever want to be. My king is the winner, take off. I live on the edges, so I'm subject to a fall. I ain't never been a loser, I ain't never gonna be. I'm like running in the rain. You don't mess around with me.
This is Lee Habib, and we're listening to Waylon Jennings, and we did that because, well, Dave Cobb said it was Waylon who took him back to the music he loved or knew when he was a kid, or actually didn't know. He knew pop country, but he didn't know this country, what I like to call real roots country. And Americana is what some people call it. And now let's pick up where we left off. How do you get into the world of being a producer? What led you to that space as opposed to being the player or being the writer? And what do you bring? What is the talent you bring to the equation that artists say, I got to work with Cobb?
Well, first of all, I think you lie your way into it, because I don't know if there's a producer school,
right?
You know? Yeah, I don't know. I was in bands and we worked with producers, and I watched them work and I thought, man, that's the life, you know? You get to kind of, it's basically a director of music, you know? You help pick the songs, you help you're kind of a friend, a therapist, you know, you're an encourager. You know, and sometimes, some instances, you're the writer. You know, you're an artist with them, or you're, you know, the musician on the record. So there's kind of a lot of hats, and it really changes every single project. You know, there's no set in stone method for my job. It's kind of, you know, you learn as you go and make it up as you go. But yeah, it's hard for people to understand what a producer is, and I really honestly don't understand either.
Good, and then hopefully you never figure it out. I think that's the key. Because then you'll start probably having a cookie cutter approach, which I think is the death of art and the death of a great production mind. I know it's true in acting and directing. Boy, you start repeating yourself, it's over.
Yeah, I agree. Well, and, you know, I don't think one suit fits all either. You know, everything's got to change. Everything's got to evolve. And you know, me personally, I would get really bored if I went in there and copied every technique I'd used on every record. It wouldn't be a very fun job, and it would become work. I like for it to be this, you know, kid's imagination land where you walk in and everything's possible and there's no limits. And I don't like rules too much, you know.
Well, so this recently, you know, a couple of Grammys, Best Country Album, Chris Stapleton's The Traveler. It's just exquisite. It feels like a record you always knew but never heard before. It feels like it's almost a part of the DNA of the culture already, and that's such a hard thing to stumble on. How did that record come to be? How did you get to know Chris?
Well, I was working with this band, Rival Sons, from California, while I was living in Los Angeles, and they played me Steel Drivers, Chris Stapleton's previous band, through an iPhone, and man, it just shut me down. I mean, you just don't hear voices like that, you know? I'm always drawn to that, whether it be, you know, Greg Allman or Rod Stewart, the kind of raspy, you know, powerhouse kind of voice. Yep. And so, you know, he was on my radar then, and it took me years to actually get a chance to work with him. His manager called and said he wanted to meet. He'd heard Sturgill Simpson album and wanted to get together. So we got together, and we pretty much talked about guitars and cars and just hit it off. And it felt like, you know, the same way you said that the record feels like a record you've always had or heard, I felt like he was a friend I'd always had, you know. And so then we went in the studio, and somehow the label was really amazing and let us go wild in the studio and really trusted us. And I think we started off, you know, well, let's cut six songs and see how it goes. And when the time we had booked for the six songs was done, we'd finished the whole record. And so the label came by and heard it and were completely supportive and just really, you know, it was an amazing time where it just felt like we were goofing off and having fun and we weren't working. It was just pure art and pure, you know, heart and soul into these days, and we came out with the record that you hear now.
You know, there's a piece or a part of the Wall Street Journal article that talked about your love of first takes and spur of the moment performances, and we had done an hour on Frank Sinatra, and it was interesting.
Oh,
Sinatra liked to go into the studio, we learned, from him himself, once, twice the most, and this is back when there were 70 or 80 set orchestras in a room, and they were union orchestras. And after that, he'd leave. He'd say, "I don't want to do a fifth take or a sixth take." Talk about that.
Well, I think I can get away with that because of the caliber of these artists and their voices, you know, and their songwriting. You know, if I didn't have Chris Stapleton singing, it may take 50 takes and never be as good, you know.
Right.
Or Sturgill or Isbell or any of these people. I mean, they're really talented and they're really good. So I think I'm really fortunate to have worked with people that just already have a God-given talent. And you're right. And after you go back past a few takes with them, I mean, their mind's on something else. They all have really active imaginations and have creative minds. So you got to capture it while they're really excited about it.
Yeah, capture
otherwise,
the spirit.
You
yep.
miss it, you know. So, but I do think I have a huge advantage because those guys are just so naturally talented. You know, they allow us to get away with doing one or two takes, you know.
You bet. You know, we were doing an hour on Cash, and we dug up some of the rare interview footage that we could, and archival footage of Cash talking to Ruben, and Ruben talking to Cash, and them talking about each other. And what was remarkable was the degree to which Cash trusted Ruben, and Ruben
right.
trusted Cash. And it just didn't sound like the hour we're getting ready for, which is George Martin, which was a very different kind of record producer. And it was much more technical, a lot of time in the studio. We're spending some particular time on Strawberry Fields and that entire Sgt. Pepper's record, which is a production piece and very intricate.
Yeah, well, George is one of my heroes for sure. I mean, you say it's a lot of time, but if you really think about how much time they took to make those records, it wasn't very long. You know, like, it was the first Beatles records was done in a day.
Yeah.
You know, And the other ones weren't, you know, a couple weeks each and maybe a month, you know. It's really relative, you know, especially now people spend months on records.
So true.
Years on records, you know.
So true.
So even that was, I think George is every bit as applicable, you know, as maybe he's one of the best, he is probably the best producer in history. I mean, the guy came in, he was a musician. He was the A&R. He designed the group. He got creative with the band. He played on the records. He arranged strings on the records. So he kind of fits the bill as the ultimate producer, really.
Yeah, we dug up a great clip where it's McCartney talking about how he had written Yesterday, and he wanted to write it for the young girls. They had different audiences they tried to appeal to with their songs. And he said, George comes in and says, I hear strings on that. And he goes, we're a rock and roll band. George, we don't do strings. Well, he went back, did the arrangement, came back, and they fell in love with the orchestral arrangement to Yesterday. And I can't imagine the song without that arrangement, Dave.
Oh, I know. I mean, I think what was so great about George Martin is that he realized how to milk every single note and every single phrase out with emotion. I mean, he really knew how to work the emotion. And I think that's what a great producer does. When you hear McCartney sing that, you feel it. You just feel every ounce of it, you know. And I think that's what he does, you know, probably better than anybody who ever lived, you know.
Yeah, let's talk about another example of your sort of no frills and spontaneous live-like production. In the band, you produce Lake Street Drive. Tell us this story of what they're looking for and how you help them achieve it.
Well, I like Lake Street Drive because of Rachel. When I heard, obviously all of them are crazy talented and their musicianship is insane. That's the other reason I liked them. But she just had a voice. I always look for a voice in a singer, and she has just such a classic voice. She has one of those voices that are so familiar. It feels like, you know, a great you've never heard, but you feel like you've heard it your whole life. So that's what attracted me to them. But, you know, they were cut much the way Traveler was cut, all in one room, even the drums in the same room, the no headphones. And it was much like a Sinatra session, the same way you described that. It was Sinatra with the orchestra. Well, it was her with the band in one room and no headphones and just, you know, just an incredible talent, all of them. Everybody in that band is the highest degree of talent, you know. So that's what drew me to them. It was a blast, you know. It was a blast. It was nice to step into their world for a little while.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk to Dave about, well, music, more on the production front, and what's coming up in the future. And we'll go out with George Martin's Strawberry Fields and the Beatles. Strawberry Fields. More with Dave Cobb after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories.
Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. No one I think is in my tree. I mean, it must be high or low. That is, you can't, you know, tune in.
Change the scene. You were looking at a magazine. It was red carpets and limousines. And the grass seemed so much greener. All we wanted was to get there fast. So we packed up everything we had. Running on hope and a tank of gas. Like dreams ain't just for dreamers. We couldn't wait to leave that life behind. trying to find salvation in that city limit sign. And one of those LA nights, when the stars come out, oh, the stars come out and shine. And the burn's so bright, they drown the downtown lights. When the stars come out, oh, when the stars come out.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we're talking with Dave Cobb. The Wall Street Journal profiled his work. We've been following it. We love music here on Our American Stories. And between Jason Isbell and Chris Stapleton, well, these are two of our favorite singer-songwriters coming up. You hear the bump music. That's Lucinda Williams. I don't think there's a better writer in the business. And wanted to pick up with the business of the business as we continue our conversation. Do you think something's happening? I mean, my sister's a professional writer. Her husband produced all kinds of big hip hop records, Naughty by Nature and Queen Latifah's records. And they both, in the 90s and the 80s and the 70s, people both hated labels, but loved labels. And then one day the labels sort of, at least for a lot of parts of the dimension of music, started to lose their influence with the sort of YouTubization of music and the downloads. But the A&R guy is just so important. And we did an hour on Ahmet Ertegun and what a life he had.
Yeah, one of my heroes, Atlantic. Yeah. One of my heroes.
What is an artist without an A&R guy? I mean, and without a producer? I mean, how does the artist today who's not hooked to or connected with someone who's going to develop them, give them the wingspan to fly, connect them with the great song if they're not writers? And in country, so often we connect, you know, your job is to connect sometimes a song to an artist. Not always, but sometimes. Talk about the labels. What's happening now in the industry? Is there sort of a rebirth of the label?
I feel like it's a really good time with record labels. I mean, I have my own imprint with Elektra Records, and I got it because I sat with everybody at Atlantic in New York. Atlantic and Elektra, you know, are the same entity. And
yep.
I did a deal with them because they sat down and they want lifestyle art. They want to find these Springsteens or these artists at last, you know, that Aretha Franklin's, you know, Led Zeppelin's. They're more interested in the in kind of the art of music, and they think, you know, when you make these real honest records, they're going to outlive, you know, a 2-second pop song. So I feel like there's a lot of that kind of opening up. I mean, Traveler was made for completely artistic purposes and it sold really well, so I think everybody's kind of looking, and so did Sturgill Simpson's Metamodern, and so did Jason Isbell Something More Than Free and Southeastern. So I think there's a wide open lane for artists to coexist with major labels and indie labels. So, but I do think labels are great, you know, in a lot of ways, because you need support, you need help. You know, if you're the artist, you can't possibly worry about, you know, making sure you get all these contracts in and making sure you do all the press and get all the radio lined up, and it's just too much to handle. So I think they can be really helpful in that degree. And they can also, you know, be great in guiding you to somebody you didn't know. Maybe they hook you up with a producer that inspires the band to go a certain way or enhances the band. So I think we're at a good time with labels. Maybe we're back where it was in the early 70s, where Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin and all these artists were on major labels and had tons of success with it. So I think maybe we're back there when people are kind of gravitating towards something real and something tangible, and the sales numbers are there to support it. I think we have a good alignment with labels now.
Well, and I also think when you have a song like Cover Me Up by Jason Isbell, that's not going to become a number one song, but it's going to be the reason why you follow him down. You're going to follow him down to the ends of the earth, because he writes music that so deeply connects with you that when he plays it in concert, you can't hear a pin drop. People are moved. Yeah. And I love concerts when they're still. And that's when you know you've done something really specific as a writer and a performer. Talk about that.
Well, I think, you know, when I did Southeastern with Isbell, I mean, I was such a huge fan of his prior. That's when I really started feeling the sea change. I mean, it just seemed like, you know, he did it through 30 Tigers on his own label, and people just came out for it. And I went to the shows, and it was the same thing. Like you said, you could hear a pin drop when he did those acoustic songs. Usually you got to go over to a show and bash people's faces off with loud up-tempo songs,
yep,
get the crowd going. But it was quite the opposite. I mean, when he played those acoustic songs, everybody felt like it was a sacred moment. And and just observed and participated. And it was just this really beautiful moment in music that I think maybe he was the first artist to really kind of open this lane that seems to exist now. You know, I think he was a guy. I think when people on Music Row were writing about, you know, tailgates, he comes out and he writes about, you know, cancer and just makes everybody think twice lyrically. I think he raised the bar lyrically.
Yeah.
And I think he really did a lot of good for Nashville and, you know, songwriting in general.
No doubt. You know, we're about to feature a song. Every once in a while, we just get under the head of our hood of a song. And we did the Nick of Time last week. Bonnie Raitt had written about how that song came to be. And it's such the lyrics are just, and they're hers. She wrote that, as you know. And we love digging under a song, and we're about to be doing next week. A friend of mine sent me a link to Daryl Mobley sitting in an artist roundtable with Kenny Chesney, and Daryl sang and performed "There Goes My Life," and it's just it is just an unbelievable song. And from the very first lyric to the second to the third verse, you're stunned at the writing and the story it tells. Talk about you know, the discovery of a great song and what that's like.
I mean, it's funny. Isbell's a really great example. When we were doing Southeastern, when he came in with the song Elephant, I mean, when you hear him sing it, you just heard the song, and I didn't want anything around it. So I put him in my kitchen in my house. I didn't want anybody influencing him. I wanted you to hear the kind of purity of where the song came from. And as he was singing it, it was coming through the speakers, and it felt like a classic record I'd never bought or heard. And it drew me in, and we all got, you know, chills and bring a tear to your eye, that the lyrics in that song. And so then after that, we added a couple overdubs to kind of fill it out. But that's one of those moments where, and somebody told me that, I think I stole this from Rick Rubin, you know it's right when it feels like a record.
Mm-hmm.
And some things feel like a great song and some things feel good, but then sometimes you'll hear something come the first time and it just feels like a record. And that song felt like a record that I'd never, you know, that I always had, but I couldn't place it. So, you know, I feel really fortunate to know people like Jason, because, you know, it makes it great when you walk in the studio and they have these songs done. You know, it makes my job real easy.
Oh yeah, it does.
You know, I pretty much concentrate on where to order dinner at that point. You know?
Yep.
So, yeah, it's rare to hear these caliber of songs, but thank God we have a few people out there that are doing it now.
And we do, and let's go out listening to Jason Isbell and the song that Dave Cobb was just talking about, Elephant.
Before she got sick, I'd never hear the end of it. She don't have the spirit for that now. We just drink our drinks and laugh out loud, bitch about the weekend crowd and try to ignore elephant somehow. She said, "Andy, you crack me up. Seagrams in a coffee cup, sharecropper eyes and the hair almost all gone." She was drunk, she made cancer jokes, made up her own doctor's notes. Surrounded by her family, I saw that she was dying alone. But I'd sing her. Heart on the run, keeps a hand on the gun, you can't trust anyone. I was so sure what I needed was more, tried to shoot out the sun. In days when we raced, we flew off the page, such damage. I made it through, 'cause somebody knew I was meant for someone. Some girl in boots by the bed. We ain't leaving this room. Someone needs medical help or the magnolias. It's cold in this house and I ain't going out to chop wood. So cover me up and know you're enough to use me for good.
This is Lee Habib, and you're listening to Jason Isbell, one of the artists that Dave Cobb produces, great singer-songwriter Chris Stapleton, and we're talking about music, the business of show business, and the radio and music business, and radio has been an integral part of this. They're pushing this music out of the pop country format. I never thought that would happen, and it is, and it's great. And Rick Rubin may have started it all with Deaf American. And then he's worked with Johnny Cash. You know, Rubin had said something interesting. He had said, well, he'd wanted to get Cash comfortable. He'd wanted to get him playing just the guitar while he sang again, just as he had done with Neil Diamond's. Just stunning. Rick Rubin, I mean, I'm not a big Neil Diamond fan. I can't take that record off the out of the CD holder. It's just so damn good. And he said, I just don't want to mess it up. My job is to not mess it up and get the connection between the song and the performer in its purest form with these guys. Is there a piece of you that worries about messing it up with your artists ever?
Not really, because I think these people were in such alignment in personal taste, you know, and it is one of those things where I think the same way. I try not to mess it up. I try to find a way to the simplest path to making the song resonate and feel. So I don't worry about that too much. Actually, to be honest with you, I think when we go in the studio, we don't worry about a lot, but trying to, you know, make the artist sound like themselves and the best version of themselves. So
that's great.
I think if we do that, maybe we'll be all right.
I wanted to talk to you about two songs from Southern Family. The first titled You Are My Sunshine by Morgan Stapleton.
Yeah.
Talk about it and the why behind it. Why did you and Morgan choose this song? It seems like an obvious choice, but perhaps an overlooked one because of it. Talk about that song.
Well, I didn't choose the song. Morgan and Chris Stapleton chose the song, and they told me they wanted to do that song for Southern Family. When I told them about the impetus of the idea, and I kind of literally laughed at them. I said, come on, you're my sunshine. That's like the lowest, you know, it's like doing, you know, we wish you a Merry Christmas, you know, or Amazing Grace. It's something that you've done a million times. And I play with them sometimes on guitar live, and they were doing a show, and I saw it in the set. They're like, we're playing Sunshine tonight. And it's a G, just follow along with us. So I go up on stage and they start playing it, and then they play it like they do on the record, and it just shut me down, and I had to apologize profusely. I mean, they reinvented the song. The only thing that's the same is the lyrics, really, and just the power that you have when they sing together is mesmerizing. And her voice, you know, on that song is so pure. And so I had to apologize, and I found out later that when they first got together, their first place had no furniture, and they picked up a guitar and they started singing that song pretty much the way it is now. So it's always meant something to them. It's their song. And Chris Stapleton actually has You Are My Sunshine on the inside of his wedding ring. So it's real personal to them. And it also kind of represents, you know, a song that every mother had sung to their child, you know, when they were children. So it's part of the fabric of American culture, I think, that song. So there's a lot of meanings to it. And I think the way they do it, they made it their own. They turned it upside down. And it's definitely just a real standout, you know, so powerful, so real. I'm in love with it, the way they did it.
Well, let's take a listen to what we pulled off of YouTube. Stapleton singing You Are My Sunshine.
You'll never know, dear.
And Dave, I guess that's what you mean by making a song their own. And thanks for sharing with us how that song came to be and the meaning and the personal meaning it had to them and what they taught you. You know, we were doing this hour on Robert Plant, and particularly his sort of resurgence with the Band of Joy. And there's this live BBC production. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but he performs with Buddy Miller and all these great Nashville cats. And the concert closes with him saying, "I want to sing a song that I've always wanted to sing that says everything." And a cappella, he starts with that beautiful gospel nugget, "I bid you good night." Then a few others join. Then a stage curtain pulls back, gospel choir, no musicians playing, just the vocals. And it stunned so many people when we played it that here's Robert Plant, the bad boy of rock and roll, returning to his roots and singing a gospel song of all things. Talk about that.
Well, that's where it all comes from, you know? I mean, I think Southern music, gospel, soul, country, bluegrass, folk, I think that's the birthplace of rock and roll, and obviously that's where he bit, you know, all his kind of influences from. So it makes perfect sense to me.
Yep. I mean,
it's kind of going back to the source about as far as you can go.
That's exactly what he had talked about. He had talked about, you know, at you know, 31 or 32, John Bonham dies, there's Led Zeppelin. And he said, "What am I going to do next? I don't want to be the head of a Led Zeppelin cover band." And he wandered, yeah. And then suddenly he links forces with Alison Krauss, and he says, "This is what I need to do the rest of my life, is explore these deep roots, the roots that inspired me to play and sing music to begin with." You've taken over RCA Studio A. For folks who don't know about it, tell us about this place, David, as we close out, what it means to you, and how does it feel in any way to be a part of such a heritage?
I mean, RCA was built in 65, this specific studio, and they recorded Elvis Presley, they recorded Dolly Parton, Jolene was cut there, Waylon Jennings, I think he did 11 records there, he did Daddy to Walk the Line there, and they did Eddie Arnold, Make the World Go Away. It's such a historic place, it's kind of like a temple that's been preserved, and it's just such a power. I think the Monkees recorded Daydream Believer there. I mean, half of my record collection growing up was recorded in this room, and it's been preserved, and it's one of the few studios that are around like it today. It's a massive place. I mean, it wouldn't even be financially feasible to build something like this now. But you walk in this place, and it's like a vintage guitar. It's got a song in it, and it's very inspiring. And we actually cut Chris Stapleton Traveler there, and we wanted to go there. Chris had the idea because it was going to be torn down. It was saved the last minute. But we thought we were the last people to record there, and it's such an amazing thing that it's still around. And now it's National Trust, so hopefully it'll be around forever. But, yeah, it's a real powerful place to be in. It's incredible to have this opportunity to be there. And I'm very humbled by the opportunity to be there. So hopefully I don't mess the history of it up. Hopefully it keeps going, you know.
Well, it's in good hands, Dave, and we appreciate you joining us here in Our American Stories. Keep up the great work. Keep inspiring us. I think music does. You know, I think C.K. Chesterton had said, "When we sing, we pray twice." And I think that's so true.
I like that. And I almost feel that. That's good.
It's all yours. And thanks so much for joining us, Dave.
Thanks so much. Y'all have a great day.
You take bet. Care. You take care. And I think the only thing to do after an interview like that is shut up and let the singer sing and the musicians play. And this is Chris Stapleton, Tennessee Whiskey, off his latest record.
Used to spend my nights out in barroom. Liquor was the only love I'd known. But you rescued me from reaching for the bottom and brought me back, being too far gone. You're as smooth as Tennessee whiskey. Honey, I stay strong on your love. Oh.
those places. Found the bottom of the bottle's always dry.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with a light from above. From the mountains to the prairies to the oceans white with foam. God bless America, my home, sweet home. God bless America, my home, sweet home.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. Ronan Tynan singing Irving Berlin's classic. And we're playing that because on this day in history, Margaret Thatcher died. And I know you're thinking, why not play God Save the Queen? We were just talking about that. But Thatcher's love of America, America's love of Thatcher, was special. It invoked that great relationship between Churchill and FDR. And no two countries are closer. It's not possible to be closer. And she loved her favorite songwriting. And songwriters were not the British artists. It was Irving Berlin. And it was Cole Porter. And it was the big bands. And it was the Broadway writers. And so that's why we bumped in with Irving Berlin. There was no better Broadway writer. He was Broadway. And this day in history is always brought to us by Hillsdale College. And Hillsdale, by the way, was a favorite place of Margaret Thatcher. She spoke there three times. And she actually said this about Hillsdale. Hillsdale College symbolizes everything that is good and true in America. And she also said, Europe was created by history. America was created by philosophy. And we're going to learn in the beginning here, in this first part of this hour on Margaret Thatcher, about her philosophy and about her early life that shaped her philosophy and one person in her life. And that's her father. But a bit about Thatcher first. She was the first female prime minister in British history, the longest serving prime minister since 1885. And always you have to start in the beginning, as I said. And baby Margaret was born in an upstairs room above her father's corner shop in the town of Grantham, an upstairs that she would call her home. There was no running water, no central heat, no bathroom. They had to go outside across the backyard of the shop to get to the lavatory. This was not a well-to-do family, but what they lacked in material things, they made up for in other ways. Her life was so very shaped by her father's life, and she was asked by an interviewer what part of that upbringing shaped her the most, the Methodist upbringing, the fact that her father was a shopkeeper, or just the nature and character of her dad. Let's take a listen to Margaret Thatcher's answer.
It was my father who shaped my character. He was a Methodist and he was a shopkeeper. But nevertheless, both those things did have a great effect. First, if you are brought up over a grocer's shop, you're used to going down frequently to calls which come in at any time of the day and perhaps after hours. So your work doesn't stop. Secondly, you're used to talking to people. And so I learned to be in there. I learned to be with people. I learned to listen to what I thought was really rather exciting things about what was happening. The same thing happens, I think, when you're a very active member of a church. You learn always to be with people. You learn to give.
You learn to give. And let's hear some more from Margaret Thatcher about her father's influence on her life.
One other thing underlined every single thing we did. You were taught the value of work. You were taught to work. You were taught it was wrong to be idle. You were taught that cleanliness was next to godliness. And you were taught that if you found something was wrong in the life of the town, it wasn't enough to get up and make a speech about it. You had to go out and do something about it yourself. So all of this was very much the family ethic and the work ethic. And my father never wasted a moment. He and my mother ran the shop, and then he also was on our local council. He was chairman of our local finance committee. He was a doer. He was a giver.
He was a giver, most importantly, to his family. Alfred Roberts started his life wanting to be a teacher. A career was denied him by financial difficulties. He had to leave school at 13 in order to earn a living. But he made up for the education he missed by forming a lifelong habit of wide reading. The librarian would call him the most well-read man in Grantham. One of the passions of Alfred's life was to make sure his daughters were better educated than himself. In this endeavor, Margaret became the proverbial apple in her father's eyes. Maybe she filled the place of a son he thought he'd longed for, or perhaps her bookish, argumentative temperament appealed to Alfred's own penchant for reading and politics. Having been denied his vocation to be a teacher, he found it in his tutoring of his daughter Margaret. Let's hear about Dad's politics, and I think even more than politics, the principles that drove the man.
He was very independent, and he didn't believe being dependent on the state in any way. So we were brought up with this feeling that first, you know, it's your bounden duty to take responsibility for your own life. You work for yourself and for your family, and you save, and then you look after the unfortunate. So this was, it is our bounden duty to be independent of the state if we possibly could be. If we were really unfortunate, then and only then did we rely on the state, but it was independence. And so naturally, the whole structure of a free society, the freedom, the rule of law, the free enterprise society, the generosity to others out of your own efforts was very much more in keeping with the Conservative Party.
My goodness. She spoke absolutely perfect English, and we were actually timing some of these clips, and they all ran to about 47 seconds with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and not a stammer. It's remarkable. This is Lee Habib, the life of Margaret Thatcher. She died on this day in history, and as always, this day in history is brought to you by the folks at Hillsdale College. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. For the hour, the life of Margaret Thatcher is celebrated. Our This Day in History segment brought to you by, as always, and us, Hillsdale College, the best place in America to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, all the things that matter in life. And if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale will come to you with terrific and free online courses and content. And you merely need to go to www.hillsdale.edu. And Margaret Thatcher spoke there three times. And I don't know that there's another college in America we could say that about. In fact, I know you can't. And one of the things we found interesting, our crew here, John and Alex, dug up some really good stuff here. And the dad venerated the Oxford Book of English Verse. And Margaret was made to learn many of its poems by heart. By the way, what a great idea to get kids to memorize stuff they end up loving and owning for life. A stanza Margaret learned in childhood and often quoted in adulthood was this. The heights by great men reached and kept were not attained by sudden flight, but they, while their companions slept, were toiling upwards through the night. And that's Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, the latter of St. Augustine. And that's the thing about literature. It embeds principles. It embeds narrative into a child's life. And then they become the things they read. I so often worry about some of the things my little girl watches. She loves watching CSI. It's a dark, dark show. And I don't know what it's doing for her, and I'm going to try and get her off this show. Because it sticks with people. It sticks in their head, in their subconscious. What we choose to have our kids read can actually shape them. And so we learn a little more about Margaret Thatcher and her studies in college. And it's not what you'd think. She studied chemistry. And why? What led her to that?
I think I had a very, very good teacher in chemistry who really inspired one's imagination, taught chemistry, taught the wonders of science. And they are wonders. And they were unfolding so fast in those days. So a whole new world was developing. And it was quite clear that science was going to be the thing. The plastics, the dyes, the new materials, the new radio, the new communications. So it was a very good thing if you wanted to be sure of a job to go on the scientific side, and added to that a fascinating teacher who taught marvelously. I think children's interests are often engaged by their teacher.
Ain't that a fact? And by the way, she was proudest, she often said, of not just being the first woman prime minister, but even more importantly, being the first prime minister with a science degree. How about that? So what was her first job out of college? It wasn't an assistant or an intern for a politician.
I got a job first in plastics when we were developing things, and then also in a food company. Ice cream was one of its products. What we did was two things. We did a certain amount of process control, and also we did in that laboratory, it was one of the companies, a big company, which believed it was its duty to engage on some basic fundamental research. And we, in those days, did some work on the chemistry of surfaces.
How about that? And there aren't many politicians you can say that about in the United States, too. And I wish sometimes our Congress wasn't filled with as many lawyers. It disturbs me, actually, because lawyers don't really know much about anything. But that's another show. That's a whole nother show. I'll play some Justice Scalia on this point. Rest in peace. And here we have a clip of her talking about this call, this pull to the political life and her first run for office.
I ran for Parliament when I was 23.
You're amazing.
As a candidate, I learned a lot from it. I worked in a tough Labour area, and I have just loved it. It wasn't that I went into it. It was that I couldn't get away from it.
I couldn't get away from it. And by the way, you hear this about most people I know who love what they're doing. They couldn't get away from it. At the tender age of 24, she began running for Parliament, and in 1958, she would finally make it there at age 33 and quickly rose through the ranks of her party. And in 1975, she became the first woman to gain the leadership of a major party in the UK and held an approach towards governing that was different from many party folks at that time, as she told William F. Buckley Jr. on his show, Firing Line.
For years now in British politics, this word, you must use it, consensus, has reared its head. You must have a consensus. It's a word, again, you used not to use when I first came in politics. We had convictions. And we tried to persuade people that our convictions were the right ones. And it's no earthly good having convictions unless you have the will to translate those convictions into action. But politics was more, if you had convictions, than a matter of multiple maneuverings to get through the problems of the day. I often think when you're going for consensus, so often it means that those who believe, as I believe, tend to give in to the left wing and you steadily move further and further left. Now, I'm in politics because of conviction. But I know that the last election, the previous election, was fought in Britain on what I think is one of the most damning sentiments ever uttered. And it was by the predecessor to Mr. Callaghan, Harold Wilson. What the British people wanted, he said, was a bit of peace and quiet, anything for a quiet life. Now, you know and I know that this is the great drag on democracy, that people will say, does my voice count? Can I do anything? And therefore they leave it to a tiny, well-organized minority. Now, you ask, have people learned? Yes, they are learning that if you do leave it to that tiny, well-organized minority,
unpleasant things happen.
Unpleasant things happen, and you then recoil from that. Mm-hmm. In part, you expect your politicians to do something about it. The question is whether the people themselves will back up the politicians.
Sounds like it still applies today, doesn't it? Thatcher believed that in governing folks, they have to choose a side in a battle between liberty and security. She clearly had made her choice, as you'll hear in this clip once again with William F. Buckley.
Yeah, you call it a hierarchy of values. I say what matters to you. And if I lose liberty, then it takes away the basic reason for living.
So what is
if you're the sort of person who doesn't mind about having any liberty, provided you've got a house and food coming to you and you will do what you're told to do, then perhaps you won't mind. I suppose it's the difference between being born free and living life like an animal at the zoo in a cage.
Yeah.
All right. Some animals do live lives in cages. But, I mean, for me, freedom
is
part of life.
It's both.
Well, so I only use that as an example to show that the difference between you can have total security without any freedom.
Sure, sure. Well, now,
that would be attractive. Not to me at all.
Not to me at all. What's unique and what I love about the British political system is that this battle between liberty and security takes place very publicly. And like the dorks we are here, we actually watch some of it on C-SPAN. And very directly, with both sides literally facing each other on opposite sides of the House of Commons, in an almost weekly bout called Question Time, where members of the Parliament can pose and debate any question with the Prime Minister, which Thatcher would become in 1979. Here, Prime Minister Thatcher is in the midst of this battle.
I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
There is no doubt that the Prime Minister has in many ways achieved substantial success. There is one statistic that I understand is not, however, challengeable, and that is that over her 11 years, the gap between the richest 10% and the poorest 10% in this country has widened substantially.
That's right.
How can she say at the end of her chapter of British politics that she can justify many people in a constituency such as mine being relatively much poorer off, much less well housed, and much less well provided than it was in 1979? Surely she accepts that is not a record that she or any Prime Minister can be proud of.
Mr. Speaker, all levels of income are better off than they were in 1979. But what the Honourable Member is saying is that he would rather the poor were poorer, provided the rich were less rich.
This is Lee Habib. More Lady Thatcher after these messages.
Forget this fundamental truth. The state has no source of money other than the money people earn themselves. If the state wishes to spend more, it can do so only by borrowing your savings or by taxing you more. And it's no good thinking that someone else will pay. That someone else is you. There is no such thing as public money. There is only taxpayers' money.
This is Lee Habib, and that was Margaret Thatcher. And on this day in history, Margaret Thatcher died, and we're celebrating her life. And few people spoke so beautifully, so forcefully, with such conviction than Margaret Thatcher. I love the way she explained the difference between consensus and conviction. And I think that's what's playing out here in American politics right now. And again, we do not do political shows. But when we do this day in history, we cover Levi Strauss. We covered Muddy Waters. But my goodness, you've got to cover Margaret Thatcher. And so, when Thatcher became prime minister, we got to go back to the time. Socialist policies had created tremendous stagnation in her home country. And more damning than that, it was just despair. As we hear about from Kelvin McKenzie, the editor of The Sun.
It was so awful. You weren't going anywhere. Your parents lived in a council flat. You were living in a council flat. You had a crappy job. Your parents had a crappy job, you were going to have a crappy job. Your parents had a crappy car, you're going to have a crappy car. Your kids, don't worry about that, they're going down the same road. We were basically North Korea, but without the hope.
And here's Prime Minister Thatcher's response.
They think it's attractive to offer to the young a future wholly controlled by the operation of the socialist state. What is their message? To each his own pigeonhole. From each, total conformity. We utterly reject it.
Fantastic. And so up till now, we've brought you Margaret Thatcher's childhood. You learned about her father, her chemistry degree, her runs for office. Finally, Prime Minister, you're hearing her rhetorical flourishes and her style. Now let's see how she put it all into practice. And see how she approached her fiercest sparring partner.
Massively powerful trade unions who basically had the country by the cojones, and every time they wanted something, squeeze.
When it was nationalised, if they could just call a strike and they knew that they'd have the country to ransom, because if they didn't get what they wanted, everything was shut down.
And so the union leadership could call a strike without balloting its members.
Yes.
You had to be a member of the trade union to work there.
Yeah, you did.
You had to go on strike.
You had to be a member of the trade union, otherwise you couldn't work there. And that's what happened.
That was what was killing British industry.
Yeah, of course it was.
From midnight last night, rail services used by more than 2 million people were shut down.
It was the guys on the shop floor who were okay. It was the trade union leaders who were the problem.
And now we'll hear about one of those trade union leaders from Dr. Larry Arnn, president of Hillsdale College, a college, as we told you before, that was a great friend of Prime Minister Thatcher's. She visited the campus in 1994 and made many other appearances on their behalf. And Thatcher was also a friend of Dr. Arnn's, although in typical Dr. Arnn fashion, he refused to accept that title. He said she was such a great person, and friendship is for equals. I was her admirer. Well, the occasion in which Dr. Arnn speaks here was Hillsdale's unveiling of a statue of Thatcher on their campus on April 22nd, 2013, only days after she had passed, the only statue of her in North America. Here's Dr. Arnn on that particular union leader.
There was a man named Arthur Scargill, who was a very left-wing, I think he called himself a communist, who was the head of the coal miners' union, and the coal miners were tough because people got their heat from coal, and so if they didn't mine coal in the winter, then people got cold. And there was a major political party, the other major political party than hers, that was basically controlled in its governing structure by the labor unions. And the worst or most aggressive of them was the coal miners. And Margaret Thatcher stored up a bunch of coal to get ready for a strike because she knew this guy was going to do it. And he called a strike, and he, in the coal mining regions of the country, they had thousands of people picketing many, many companies. And parts of the country basically stopped to function. It had happened many times. And there was in 1984, I think it was, the Battle of Orgreave, it was called. There were 5,000 miners and there were 5,000 policemen who showed up to arrest them. And they arrested them all. And there was 130 casualties. And I think that was a battle for the soul of the country. And Prime Minister Thatcher, she was then, could remember her going on TV, happened to be there for much of that time in 1984. I had gone back to do some work. And she was just very clear about it. She said that the stakes in this are enormous, and we're going to stand up for the country. And she had that, she's the only politician I've ever seen who made powerful rhetorical use of the word nothing. She loved the word nothing. And nothing was always applied in this sense. Nothing will make us go back on our responsibilities. And I noticed what the use of that word did in interviews, for example, because journalists love to get you to say, of course, I'm mindful of the other side. And then they begin to ask a series of leading questions about how you'll move that way. If nothing is your opening position, what's the follow-up question? You know, if the four horsemen of the apocalypse show up, nothing, she says. And what happened was a large part of the membership of the mine workers seceded from the union and formed their own union and made a deal that was very lucrative for themselves, but not what had been demanded. And she basically broke that strike, and she broke that kind of unionism. The other kind, the kind where people under laws that are fair and don't let people take over parts of the country or the property of others, that kind thrives in Britain today. But, you know, there has not been an effort to bring back that old kind, not since she did that.
And nobody explains these things like Dr. Arne. And our This Day in Histories are always brought to you by Hillsdale College. And what a place to go and study. I love going back each year. This year, I'll be teaching there for 2 weeks, and I'll be bringing the crew. And we will be broadcasting from Hillsdale College and using some of their students as interns. My goodness, in many parts of this country, that's practically illegal. I was talking to somebody yesterday, a bunch of small business owners, and they were talking about how they were afraid to hire interns because of some new rules that have been passed by the federal government. And they're now making folks pay their interns. And that's just not real credible thing to do, and a lot of folks aren't doing it. We're not afraid here to do that, and we have a couple of good law degrees here, and we're willing to work with some interns at some of our finer colleges, and Hillsdale is one of those colleges. And when we come back after these messages, we're going to close out our hour with more of Margaret Thatcher, the first female prime minister in the history of England. Again, more after these messages. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And you can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to catch all of our stories. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And this is our final segment, an hour on Margaret Thatcher. And our This Day in History, as always, is brought to you by Hillsdale College. And there is no better place in this country to learn about our nation's history, the Constitution, great literature, all the things that matter in life. And again, if you can't get to Hillsdale, Hillsdale will come to you with their terrific and free online courses at www.hillsdale.edu. And so we were learning about Prime Minister Thatcher's struggles with unionism. By the way, the same thing was happening in the United States. New York was in deep trouble. Drop dead. Do you remember that headline in the New York Post or Daily News? The federal government had said, we're not bailing you out. And New York City was teetering on bankruptcy. Detroit, so many of our big cities being run down by the big unions. So this was a fight that Western democracies were having to run down. And Lady Thatcher was leading the fight in her home country. That old kind of unionism that she battled and defeated. When she took office in 1979, there were 4,600 work stoppages and 29 million lost working days. And when she left office 11 years later, there were only 630 work stoppages and under 2 million working days lost. And this was only the beginning. Many industries were nationalized and weren't working for the people, from gas to water, electricity, telephone, steel, and coal. And so she shook things up and ended up privatizing them.
The forces of reaction, or the establishment, were shocked by what we were suggesting.
I was told time and time again, often by Tories, no one will want to buy the shares, and you'll have riots, the workers won't accept it, and the standards will fall away.
Those who thought this share offer would not hold much attraction for the small investor were proved wrong this morning. Applications were arriving even before it got light.
All our push in our policies was to spread ownership.
Telecom's aim has been to get as many individuals as possible to buy shares. The stock exchange has never experienced anything like it.
And it was done in a most dramatic fashion.
Telecom says there's every sign that it'll be deluged with applications from ordinary members of the public for the shares. The response has been so great it's hired extra staff.
Smaller investors were given preferential treatment, while workers were encouraged to buy shares in their own industries.
The trade union bosses told their members that on no account must they subscribe for shares, and the members ignored them completely.
When British Steel was privatised, 94% of workers bought shares. When National Power was privatised, 99% of workers bought shares. Privatisations of British Telecom and gas were massively oversubscribed.
The forms are coming in so fast, we literally can't count them.
99% of people on the steelworks where I work, they all bought shares. And it was a fantastic opportunity. Sweet dreams
are made of these. We increased the number of individual shareholders to 9 million.
If you had predicted in the 1960s that in just a decade or two's time, share ownership will be more common than trade union membership, you would have been laughed at. But actually, that's what happens.
As Mrs. Thatcher predicted, privatisation didn't just change ownership, it changed attitudes.
Everybody was encouraged to work hard to get the bonuses.
It was so you were sharing in profits.
Sharing in profits.
Part owner of the company.
That's right.
And it alters your perspective on
it. It does. It was fantastic. It was.
For the newly privatised state industries, there would be no more government bailouts. They made a profit or they died. The transformation was breathtaking. Almost overnight, the long waiting lists for telephones and gas cookers disappeared. Former state organisations, which had been dismissive and rude to their customers, now had to fight for their business. So
if you want to pop your... If you look at the productivity gains when you actually move something from the public sector to the private sector, in almost all cases, it looks like magic.
Magic it was. And Thatcher also shook up another big sector, housing. In Britain, you had to ask the government permission to build your own home, and many folks resigned to living in government housing.
At the end of their lives, they had nothing. They passed on nothing to their children. They had nothing to call their own except maybe a television and some furniture, and that would be about it. And what she did was say to them all of a sudden, you can own the most important thing in your life, your home.
Why do you need to own your own house? The house prices weren't going anywhere, you weren't going to make a big fortune. You know, why did it matter? But actually, it did seem to matter. So deep down inside people, they wanted something more. than the state handing them stuff.
How about that? Almost a third of Britons lived in government housing when Thatcher took office. That's staggering. By the time she left, only 23% did. Home ownership increased from 50% in 1971 to 68% in 1991. Remarkable on its own, and yet all of Thatcher's reforms worked larger pictures than revolutionizing particular sectors. They revolutionized a nation and its spirit.
Britain was known for suffering from the British disease. Now we're known for having the British cure.
What is surprising, looking back, is how quickly the Thatcher Revolution transformed Britain. From being the sick man of Europe, you know, the once proud but now ailing giant which had no future, it only took something like 4 or 5 years to turn that around completely.
The message may not have reached the Labour Party, but it certainly reached our friends and competitors abroad. Despite the world recession, despite those long years under Labour, Britain is back in business.
There was a real British economic story that was then told the world over, and that was an incredible legacy that she has left us.
Thatcher's revolution unleashed an economy whose real GDP would grow by 23% while she was in office, and she took inflation down from 18% to 8.6%. And then there's her other legacy, the great one. And that, along with Ronald Reagan, and ultimately Pope John Paul II, battling communism. And like all of her battles, directly to communism's face. In this case, a man named Gorbachev.
Over the lunch table, she said to him, "Welcome to the United Kingdom, Mr. Gorbachev, and to Czechos. I want our relationship to get off to a good start. I want there to be no misunderstanding between us. I hate communism."
That's sort of blunt, huh? And she backed up her words with action, tripling the UK's nuclear arsenal during her tenure as a show of strength. A strength she forged alongside her close partner in the United States and in its president, Ronald Reagan.
Many people have spoken of the sort of natural chemistry between Thatcher and Reagan. I think it came down very simply to the fact that they were kindred spirits at the level of ideas. Both of them believed in enterprise, opportunities, meritocratic society in which people wouldn't be held back by class or birth. That, I think, was fundamentally why they got on.
She and Ronald Reagan together made this extraordinarily powerful combination. She meant what she said, in the same way that President Reagan meant what he said. Above all, they could see that they had won the ideological battle and that communism was a rotten system, as they said it was, and communism would never work. And this so undermined the morale of leaders of the communist systems in Eastern Europe, above all, that the end was inevitable.
Well, we've seen a tide of liberty sweep across Eastern Europe in the last 12 months, one nation after another.
And, like all political lives, it had to come to an end. And an end which came suddenly. She lost a power struggle within her own party, even after all the success she led them to.
If you're in politics, you expect to be knifed in the back. What I will never forgive is that I was away in Paris, and there was a vote on whether I should continue to be leader. And this was after nearly 11 years when I had taken Britain from the slough of despond to the heights. It was the most difficult evening of my life. I shall never forget, and I shall never forgive.
Even though Thatcher did not leave on her own terms, she did have the final word, and will have the final word in history. Here she is upon her exit at 10 Downing Street.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're leaving Downing Street for the last time after 11 and a half wonderful years, and we're very happy that we leave the United Kingdom in a very, very much better state than when we came here 11 and a half years ago.
And there you have it, this day in history, Margaret Thatcher's life. I wanted to do a reading, one quick story, and it's a quote. And here's what she says, and I want to lead and leave with her words. I think we've been through a period where too many people have been given to understand that if they have a problem, it's the government's job to cope with it. I have a problem, I'll get a grant. I'm homeless, the government must house me. They're casting their problem on society. And you know, there is no such thing as society. There are individual men and women, and there are families. And no government can do anything except through people. And people must look to themselves first. It's our duty to look after ourselves first. And then also to look out after our neighbor. People have got the entitlements too much in mind without the obligations. There's no such thing as entitlement unless someone has first met an obligation. This is Lee Habib on This Day in History. Margaret Thatcher died.